Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Welcome to this week's episode of Money Tree Investing Podcast. I appreciate you joining us today. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I have an exciting show for you guys today. Today, we're going to be talking about tax loopholes for the rich and economic opportunity zones. Our guest today is Matt Chancy. But before we get to Matt, let's talk about Betterment. Are you looking for a better way to invest during market turmoil? Consider Betterment. Betterment is a robo-advisor that uses time-tested principles of modern portfolio theory to help you manage your wealth and reach your financial goals. With Betterment, you don't have to worry about the market, what it's doing on a day-to-day basis. Instead, Betterment allows you to use the stock market to consistently build wealth. For more information, visit moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment. A lot of investors use Betterment, but it doesn't mean it's the right thing for you. Do your own research. Check out moneytreepodcast.com/Betterment to see if Betterment is the right fit for you. So this week's guest is Matt Chancy. Matt works for high income and high net worth clients nationally to legally reduce taxes on income and capital gains. Matt has over 15 years of experience in the financial industry working with high-profile clients. He's generally sought after for education, teaching, and guest speaking within the industry. He's been featured on a number of national media outlets, and he focuses a lot on advanced tax planning. A lot of this requires timing, shifting, and IRS codes in combination with tax advantage products. He's developed a lot of different resources in the industry for other advisors to use, but you know, we brought him on because Matt's one of the more knowledgeable tax experts I know when it comes to financial planning. Welcome to the show, Matt.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate the invite.
So I wanted to talk a little bit about, there's this concept of economic opportunity zones. I wanted to have you on because I know you're one of the more sought after experts in this area. It's a really new topic. A lot of people don't know all about them. And even people in the industry generally don't know because it's new. There's a lot of guidance coming out, but maybe you can kind of start by telling us a little about what they are and why they came into being.
You know, if you kind of go back to the history of this a little bit, this was bipartisan legislation. Both sides got on board with this. And what they were ultimately looking to do was to create some type of an economic engine that would let private capital be able to flow through and do some level of public good. And for that, and there's some other structures that exist, so there was somewhat of a precedent for this, you get some tax benefits along with making that investment. They tasked all the state governors to go out and they gave them the parameters in which to look for, to create, look for these economic zones within their states that could use private capital investment. And after they looked around the state to see where it might make sense, whether they should, there's an area they wanted to bring back or revitalize, or it was something adjacent to an area that was already starting to develop, they picked the opportunity zones. And then the hope is that private investors would want to make investment in either the physical real estate that was going to be built and developed in that area, or there would be businesses that would capital would flow into that would promote job growth, economic stimulus in the area, and ultimately bring hopefully new people to the area from a residential standpoint, increase the tax base of the area, and then you get some trickle-down economic benefits from it. So the primary goal was to take areas that needed capital and find a way for private investors to be able to do that instead of the public or government or tax receipts always solving the problem.
That's great. I heard about this maybe about a year ago on another show, and the concept was just getting out there. And I was shocked. I mean, bipartisan support for anything economic related just seems far-fetched. But as you're saying, like, there's a reason for this. And I think everyone's on board as a, I don't know if you'd agree, but it sounds like it's more of like a test case. Like, maybe this is something, if it works out, we do more of it. What are you hearing on your end?
A lot of the opportunity zones were mapped over from what used to be called new market tax credits, which technically still exist. But basically, that's the investment of capital into kind of a low income area for development of businesses, private businesses in those areas, and you get tax credits that offset the return on invested capital that you actually get. So there was kind of a footprint and a framework. I don't think that was as widely adopted as what this was. They had always hoped that it would be. And so I think that's why when the regulations originally came out for the opportunity zone deal, they made it a little bit more liberal. They were hoping that more capital would want to flow there. They made it less restrictive then they would help accomplish their goal. I mean, obviously, if you look on the Republican side, they've usually always been advocates for things that have tax advantages. And on the Democratic side, they're always looking for ways to help more of their constituents and, you know, lift people up. I think it's kind of a perfect meeting in between to hopefully help them accomplish that.
I would agree with that. I mean, it seems to me like a great program to allow capital to actually go into some of these zones that are, well, let's say, lacking capital, to put it bluntly. But putting capital into these areas, either into real estate or in businesses, I mean, those are two very different concepts. So I don't know if you can kind of talk about that a little bit, because I've heard, you know, if you're looking to invest in the area, whether it's better to do real estate or a business, or how do you kind of look at that?
Well, I have a background of doing private equity real estate over the past few years. So the real estate component to me makes a lot more sense, and it's something I'm a lot more knowledgeable about. Now, I see the private business part of it as well, but I just don't think that part's where there hasn't been as clear guidance. For example, they're still not sure on if you own a business in an economic opportunity zone, where can you sell your products and where can you drive revenue? Do that sales have to be in that opportunity zone, or can the sales be nationally or globally? And then how does that affect the underlying business? So I think it's not quite as clear on the operating business side. I think it's more clear on the real estate side because it's tangible. You know, if you can invest in a piece of real estate that's being developed in an opportunity zone, you know, when an asset gets built and becomes a stabilized asset, it's pretty quantifiable what the economic value is to that particular area. And I think a lot of people understand that because it starts to generate cash flow and become maybe a centerpiece of the community.
I've been hearing a lot about this concept for a while now. And obviously, a lot of smart people like yourself have been aware of this for a while. And it makes me wonder, these economic opportunity zones have already been carved out. And smart people were in there before, because I know a few people that have been doing this, is they went in early, you know, last year and started buying up properties within these zones, which by right now, they're probably a lot more expensive and they may not make economic sense. I don't know what you've been seeing on your end, but I guess I wonder in some ways, like, is real estate already fully appreciated in these areas? Are there still opportunities for people to go in and actually make a difference?
I guess that just depends on what strategically you're trying to accomplish. You know, you make a good point. And the other day I was at a meeting with the Commercial Realtor Association, and all the realtors are trying to go to the local economic opportunity zones, find the owners of those properties and say, hey, listen, this real estate's way more valuable than you realize. We should list it and sell it, and you can make a good amount of money. As a matter of fact, I read an economic report this morning that said the underlying value of real estate in opportunity zones across the country is up 20%. You know, I don't know if that's the whole country or certain zones. I don't know where they got all their data from, but a 20% increase in the real estate value in some of those zones in this short period of time, when there really haven't been any projects even developed yet. It's just on the come that it will happen. So I think we'll have to see how that plays out over time and strategically where the value is.
It's interesting. I'm also curious where they get the numbers. I always like economic numbers because they never footnote where they're coming from. It's like they almost pull them out of thin air sometimes. But one thing I want to get back to is kind of the basics, because really, I think probably a lot of listeners of the show are not familiar with this concept because it's not widely discussed. Let's kind of talk about the basics of it. So how does this work? What are the benefits? Using a case study as an example. Let's say I've got this, I bought Apple stock at $1 and I just sold it for $1 million in December of last year. How does this work? What do I do from here?
A lot of the rules are analogous to a 1031 exchange for real estate. However, the good thing is this applies to all capital assets and their appreciation. So it can be stock, it could be real estate, it could be business, anything that has a capital gain, short-term or long-term capital gain. And unlike a 1031 exchange, you get the luxury of being able to pull apart or bifurcate the basis from the gain. And a case study, I think you're right, is a great way to give an example. So let's say somebody sells an asset for $2 million that was highly appreciated. Let's assume that $1 million of that was their cost basis. Well, what it allows them to do is to take the $1 million, pull it off of the table that was their cost basis, and put it in their pocket. No tax consequences to the basis whatsoever. Now you've got another $1 million that was all gain. It allows them to be able to take that $1 million of gain after constructive receipt up to 180 days, which means they can sell that asset, have a capital gain event, and then deploy the capital into a QOZ investment and then still receive the benefit. So they didn't have to put all this structure and this mechanism in place ahead of time. They were able to do it after the sale that created the capital gain. So they've got this $1 million of gain. They redeploy that gain into a qualified opportunity zone investment. Now, we'll talk real estate. So on that, let's just assume simple math, 20% long-term capital gains. They're going to owe $200,000 of taxes on that $1 million. If they hold that investment for 5 years, their tax literally gets reduced by 10%. So 5 years later, the $200,000 in taxes that would have been due are now only 180 grand. So their tax bill went down by 20 grand. If they hold it another 2 years, their taxes are reduced an additional 5%. So now their original tax was 200. Now it's only 170. So they've deferred their tax for 7 years. They've reduced it by 15%. In year eight, the tax is going to become due. That's a huge economic benefit anytime you can defer a tax, because if you understand the time value of money and how inflation works, you know, if inflation's 3% a year, you've almost discounted the amount of the tax by about 24% over an 8-year deferral period, which is good economics. The year eight, you'd have to pay that $170,000 of taxes. And then if you continue to hold the investment for an additional 3 years beyond the 10-year mark, that $1 million of gain capital that you had originally deployed, no matter what it grows to, becomes 100% gain on gain tax free. So ultimately, when that liquidates, you could walk away from it. And if it grew from $1 million to two or $1 million to $3 million bucks, you could walk away and it would all be tax free.
Okay, so you're saying that basically that first million, if you hold it for, let's say, 10 years, the first million, it would net around $170,000, but then you have to pay those taxes. You have to pay the $170,000, correct?
Correct. You do have to pay the $170,000.
But then the growth of the amount that you're investing into this investment, this economic opportunity zone real estate, the growth of that is tax-free until you take it out, right?
Well, it's tax-free even when you take it out, not until you take it out. Taking it out would be tax deferred, to your point. But when you liquidate that investment after the 10-year window, that there is no capital gains on the appreciation on what your $1 million of gain capital turned into. So if it turns into $3 million bucks, you would have had to pay at a 20% long-term capital gains rate $400,000 in taxes on that appreciation in a typical investment. In this scenario, absolutely no taxes need to be paid. So it's a complete forgiveness.
Can you basically just keep this in this investment forever and it'll just grow tax-free forever, or are there kind of other limitations?
In most of these investments, there's a liquidity trade-off. You're not talking about a publicly traded listed stock, bond, or mutual fund portfolio that's got the ability to sell on a secondary market or redeem the shares. So if the underlying investment is real estate, it's going to be illiquid. So you're looking for the liquidity event, ultimately the sell of the underlying real estate, to create the liquidity for you. And that is somewhat market cycle driven as well. So the tax code says 10 years till you receive those benefits. But if your underlying investment or development partner sees softness in the market or doesn't get an offer at the 10-year mark, they may hold it for 11 or 12 years to find the right buyer at the right price so that everybody gets a favorable exit. Now, the other part that you have to consider in this is that if you own real estate and it's a stabilized asset, which after the first 3 to 4 years when these become developed, they would become a stabilized asset, you're a limited partner in the structure. So you're going to see a pro rata distribution of the income that's attributable to your share. So there would be income that passes through to the client, even in the deferral mechanism or the deferral years, whether it be years 5, 6, 7, all the way up through 10, 11, 12, however long they held the investment before it liquidated, there could be an income component.
Okay. So you would potentially have to pay taxes on the income part of the real estate, even though the gains will be tax-free, but the income potentially you'd have to pay taxes on.
Correct. If you receive income from the investment, even though it's in a qualified opportunity zone structure, the income will be reportable as ordinary income. So yes, there will be tax consequences there. Now, I'll say this, there are share classes of many of the projects that are starting to come out for people that say, you know what, I don't need income on this investment. I've got other assets. I've got other sources of income. I want to maximize the tax benefits. So I would like the whole thing to be structured as a growth share for full appreciation. There's asset classes that are coming out that look and reflect that. That way, instead of having an ordinary income component to this investment, it becomes all deferred capital gain, and you get more tax juice out of it that way. So some of the structures do have that as an option.
A few other kind of follow-up questions on this. So what about state and local taxes? Is that also state and local tax-free?
Well, it depends. There are some states, states are all kind of treating this a little bit different. There are some charts out there that talk about coordination with state. I don't know them off the top of my head, but, some of the states are coordinating, other of the states aren't. And at the end of the day, it's going to come down to what each particular state thought made the most sense on if they wanted to coordinate. For example, California, with the highest state income tax at 13.3, they are not coordinating whatsoever. So it'll offset your federal, and it can work against your Medicare surtax of your 3.8%, but it's not going to work in states, like California. Actually, Alabama, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Minnesota, Mississippi, New Jersey, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Those are the ones, if you have state income tax in those states, you're going to have to continue to pay it.
No, I'm glad I'm from Massachusetts. That makes me feel all warm and fuzzy. Not that I didn't expect that out of my state. Let's get into kind of a similar area of this. You're talking about specific funds, which I think we both know the financial industry loves putting together products for people to buy, and that's just what it's all about. But do we have to buy a fund? Or what if, let's just say, I had some property, it happened to be in an economic opportunity zone? How does that work? How do I get benefits for that?
If you already own real estate in a qualified opportunity zone, the question is what are you going to do with it, right? Not everybody that owns real estate is capable of being able to execute on either an underlying business or be able to develop a piece of real estate and make it become economically viable. So, if you're in that business and that's what you do, you build hotels, you build apartment complexes, you build self-storage facilities, and there's a real benefit to your geographic area needing that asset class, then that could make a lot of sense. If not, you're probably going to want to, and this is coming from my area of expertise, what I know is you're probably going to want to find a development partner and say, hey, I own this land. Here's what I think the highest and best use is. For us to raise capital, we're in a great situation because there's tax benefits associated with this piece of dirt in this area. But I don't know how to build a hotel. This is not something I've done. So maybe partner with a general partner. You're contributing the land. They're bringing in the expertise of how to do it. You're raising limited partner gain capital. And together, you could execute on that project together. But I would say if it were me, knowing what I know, if you don't have the expertise but own the real estate or the asset, and from a highest and best use perspective, it makes sense to do this, go find you a really good partner that can operate and execute on the other side.
So if people had a good advisor and they had, they had knowledgeable partners, then they really could do this themselves. They don't need to buy a product. They could either use land that they already owned in an economic opportunity zone, or they can acquire property if they didn't want to buy someone else's product, right?
Yeah, somebody has the capabilities of doing it and they have the assets that it takes to pull it off, the physical assets today, then yeah, they wouldn't necessarily have to invest in a fund. What I am seeing today, though, is the early movers, the real high quality assets and stuff out there are institutional. It's people that already knew how to do it and already had stuff in the pipeline. The mom and pops and the onesie twosies, they're all still trying to figure it out how to connect the dots. And the real high quality stuff, the institutional players, it's kind of already stuff that's in the pipeline.
I see the term thrown around fund, economic opportunity zone fund. Does it have to be a fund in the traditional way, or what are the qualifications for that? Because I know that term's thrown around, and to me, it just seemed a bit weird that it had to be a quote unquote fund.
The way most of the people are structuring the fund today is that's just a term that I think a lot of people are comfortable with, and they understand the concept of potentially putting money into a fund. So you deposit your gain capital into the fund. The fund is looking for shovel-ready turnkey projects, and then they are going to add those assets to the fund as they develop them. Or some of the fund sponsors are going to create smaller feeder funds where once they identify a project that's shovel-ready to go, they will drop down some assets from the core fund to the feeder fund that will then acquire this single asset for development in that project. The key is understanding what's in the fund and what they're going to invest in, right? You know, in many scenarios, if you trust the management team, you know they've got great expertise, you know they're looking out for you, and you understand the type of assets they've developed before, maybe you're okay being in a blind pool type scenario where you really don't know what they're buying or what they're doing and what the underwriting and the economics are going to look like. However, if you don't have that level of comfort and you want to get there with it, then you wouldn't necessarily want a blind pool. You would want to say, hey, what assets do you have in your pipeline? What are you going to build? What are you going to develop? What are the economics on that look like? And I think that is creating some uncertainty in the industry, because there's a lot of marketing today that I'm starting to see about, here's the tax benefits associated with our fund. But they're not telling you what the underlying assets may or may not be, what the expected returns, and historically what they've been able to provide to investors. So there's that old expression out there, letting the tax tail wag the investment dog. If you're getting into it only for the tax advantages and not understanding the underlying economic drivers of where the returns are going to come from, then you might be disappointed when it's all said and done. And if you're disappointed after a 10 or a 12 year potential hold to get all the tax benefits, you know, that might be just time you can't get back.
That was always my concern with these, is you're effectively locking yourself up for, you know, let's say 7 to 12 years, depending on what they're trying to do. But let's say 10 to 12 years. And it's great for a tax perspective, but you're basically deferring that tax. But then if the investment itself doesn't perform, you're just wasting time. You just lost time value of money. So you're not benefiting ultimately from what this could become, which I think certainly that's always been my concern, is anything you invest in, it's the underlying has to perform, or it's not worthwhile. I mean, so I wanted to ask one more question about this to touch on some other tax loopholes that you kind of specialize in. But when it comes to something like this, let's say it was like a business. Actually, let's just talk about with real estate. What are the requirements? I've heard that you can't just buy the property and then sit on it and then sell it 10 years later. Like, you have to actually reinvest into the property. Do you know what the stipulations are for that?
Yeah, I do. And I'll cover a couple of pieces of this. As you know, when you were talking, you got me thinking about something. So it's substantial improvement, which is the definition is like 100% improvement over the cost basis, right? That's why most of the projects that economically are viable today are development projects, because you're going in and you're just literally starting with dirt or something that there's not an expensive asset on it, and you have to improve the economic value of it by more than 100%. Well, that's really hard to do maybe in a rehab scenario where you buy a building and you go in and we're going to put money into this building to substantially improve it. It might be hard to improve the value of something on a rehab basis by more than 100%. But on a new construction and a development project, it's substantially easier to accomplish that. So most of the high quality assets that I've seen today are pure ground up development deals. Let me say this. I have a due diligence background, and over the past couple of years, I've looked at about 80 different private equity real estate. Not all real estate, but primarily, I would say probably 80 or 90% of the deals I've looked at have been real estate deals that I've due diligenced across the country. This is part of what I do in my day to day. So understanding that there are good players out there that build apartment complexes, that build student housing, that build nursing homes, that build self-storage facilities, that build industrial distribution centers, knowing that those people are out there in that space, this is their core business. This is what they do. So when now all of a sudden an economic opportunity zone legislation passes, for me, and I'm fortunate clearly due to these circumstances, but all I had to do was call some of the development partners that we've been placing capital with over the past few years and say, hey, did you have anything in your pipeline that happened to be a market rate project that was already developable, but you were already going to develop because the economics made sense without the tax benefits? And so that was kind of the luxury that I had, and how I got kind of backed into knowing so much about this space, because a lot of my development partners were like, yes, absolutely. We were going to build 15 hotels this next year anyway. They were already in our pipeline, and five of them just happened to be in qualified opportunity zones. Because what a lot of people miss is the census data that created this was from the year 2010, 2010 was 9 years ago, and there's been a massive amount of economic redevelopment in many of the zones over the past 9 years. They are not necessarily low-income areas anymore. Many of them are market-rate projects. So between those factors and being able to call people I had already been doing business with that had already been treating my investors well and say, hey, listen, what do you have in the pipeline? I'm sitting on about a $2 billion footprint of institutional quality market rate projects that just coincidentally happen to have tax benefits associated with it. So I guess I kind of happen to be in the right place at the right time.
So I want to touch on one other topic because we don't have too much time to get into all the tax loopholes that you have, but we'll have you on again to talk about some of the other ones. And just for the listeners of the show, you might be listening to this saying, oh my God, taxes. But as you get more and more wealthy, as you age and you're acquiring more wealth, one of the more important things is to really understand how to protect your wealth from Uncle Sam and taxes. Because if you really want to compound your wealth, that's one of the ways you can do it is by minimizing the amount of tax you have to pay, either at the end of the day or somewhere along the way, like retirement accounts, which you can defer in many cases, defer your taxes till your retirement. These are all really important. And if you look at some of the smarter investors out there, some of the wealthier ones, this is what they focus on. They're not worried about making the most amount of money possible. They're worried about making the most net amount of money possible. That's why I want to bring on Matt. If you really want to learn about this stuff, he's one of the smarter guys I know in this area. So Matt, I wanted to talk a little bit about, you have this concept of Roth conversion, discounted Roth conversion, which we certainly do a lot of. We specialize in self-directed IRAs, and we deal with a lot of alternative assets inside of retirement accounts. So, we love being creative with these type of things. But I wonder if you can talk about this, because I think it's an additional way to reduce your taxes.
The financial services space is a system, right? And it's like a body, per se. If you go to the doctor and you're talking to the doctor and he's asking about your health, he's going to ask, how are you sleeping? Are you drinking alcohol? Are you smoking cigarettes? What's your diet like? Are you getting any exercise? And all those things affect how you feel. Well, in the financial space, it's very analogous to what it would be like going to a doctor, because it's investments, insurance, retirement, estate, and taxation. Those are the five core pillars of planning. But to your point, the higher the net worth or the higher the income the client, they want and need all of those services, but they all want to start the conversation around tax because that's a biggest pain point for that client. They're getting hammered in taxes because it's a progressive tax system the more that they make. So finding ways to meaningfully solve the tax problem is extremely important. And that's why some of these structures are called tax equity structures. Where else can you get potential deductions and or credits and help you increase your net worth through tax saving? So yes, I agree with you on that. One of the things that we've been asked over the years is, I think many clients have heard, hey, what about this Roth conversion? Does this work? When does it make sense? And all these other factors. Well, today, we are in one of the best economic environments, well, tax environments, to be able to do a Roth conversion from a couple of factors. When the Tax Cuts and Job Acts came down, the tax brackets all shifted, and they shifted down and they shifted wider apart. And what I mean by that is today, the goal of any type of conversion planning is to force as many dollars as you can through the lowest marginal bracket when it's a known variable, because in the future, what tax rates are going to be, we don't know. And heaven forbid, if something like the new Green Deal were to pass, not that that's a bad thing, but there's talk that we could have 60, 70, 80% top marginal brackets. It's going to be really hard to push dollars through 20% brackets if we have an 80% marginal one. So from a Roth conversion standpoint, what we're looking at is how does we get as many dollars as possible through the lowest brackets? And today for a married filing jointly couple, all the way up to $315,000 of income is only taxed at 24%. When you go over that, it jumps to a 32% breakpoint. So if somebody were looking to convert to a Roth, let's say they made $200,000 in income, if they converted an IRA, $115,000 of it, that $115,000 of conversion with their $200,000 of ordinary income now makes them feel like they have $315,000 of income. The conversion on the $115,000 would happen at 24%, which is a known number and a relatively low rate historically, especially the way the brackets recently shifted. Here's the other part. The sunset potential on those brackets changing is in 2025. We've got 6 years to potentially do as many Roth conversions at the lower tax brackets than what we had just a few years ago and what we'll have after 2025. So we're in a real sweet spot to do that. But here's where you even get a little bit more juice out of being able to do a Roth conversion. And I know you're a big fan of the self-directed IRA, as are we, and the types of assets that you can potentially hold in there. So you don't necessarily have to be holding the stocks, bonds, mutual funds. We use a lot of private investments. That's my background. That's what I know. Well, in private investments, there can be reasons that you would potentially discount the value. Lack of marketability, lack of liquidity, lack of transferability. There's a lot of different potential reasons. So with some of the investments that we use in an alternative IRA, we can get an independent third-party valuation that will give us an asset value that's at least, if not more, than 40% less than the actual value of the underlying asset or the capital that was deployed. Let me give you an example on that. Let's say a client has $1 million IRA. We invested in this particular type of an asset. Once we get back that third-party appraisal, the appraisal will literally come back and say that asset is now worth $600,000 on paper. If at that point we convert the IRA, and let's just make a simple assumption that all the assets were going to fall in the top 40% marginal bracket, which they wouldn't, but just for illustrative purposes, well, a 40% tax on $600,000 is $240,000 in taxes to convert that $1 million IRA, which if you did not use any type of a discounting methodology and you converted $1 million IRA at a 40% bracket, you'd pay $400,000 in taxes on that conversion. So there's a huge difference. Say there's $160,000 tax savings in that scenario to be able to discount those underlying assets. Now, given we need to make sure it's appropriate, we need to make sure concentration levels matter, we need to make sure that we're using the marginal brackets the right way. We don't want to convert everything in the largest brackets. But when you back into all the math, at the end of the day, we can fit 40% more of their assets through the lower marginal brackets by using discounts.
We love this strategy. I mean, we've used this a few times, and I want to reiterate for listeners, this is all legal. These are loopholes that people know about that have these issues, have these tax issues, and want to minimize taxes. You can look this stuff up. It is clearly defined. Now, obviously, you have to meet certain criteria, you know, getting valuations. You can't just pull numbers out of thin air. But this is phenomenal stuff. We like to talk about one of the former presidential candidates who has a $104 million IRA or something in that nature. We know of some that have 10x that. So there's enormous IRAs, and these are the kind of things that people do in order to get this kind of tax treatment so they can benefit, and especially through these times, as Matt's saying. But ultimately, you need to understand how this stuff works. You need to work with professionals that really understand this stuff. It's not child's play, right, Matt? You studied a lot of textbooks to learn this stuff. You didn't just pull it out of thin air.
Believe it or not, I'm like a super geek. I don't know where that comes from. I wouldn't say this is the type of thing that, you know, you would just want to try on your own. And then I tell people all the time that everybody thinks that taxes are binary, like a light switch. And I disagree with that. But I think taxes and tax planning are more like a thermometer, because you can stack a lot of these different strategies together and you get more of a cumulative benefit. So if it's like a thermometer, you tell me how hot or how cold you want it, and I can adjust it and dial it up or dial it down according to your comfort level. Because I can use 40% for a discount with a client, but it's not uncommon for me to be able to stack another methodology on top of that and potentially get as much as a 70% discount. Now, I know that that sounds crazy, but it's very doable. And when I present it to people all the time, the biggest objection I get is, this sounds too good to be true. I've never heard of this. Where's this coming from? And what I tell those clients all the time is, you know, listen, at the point in time when you started making way more money than everybody else and started accumulating way more assets than everybody else, there's no one that sends you a letter and says, hey, you've got more money, you've got more stuff, you can now do these really cool things that the average person can't do. The bulk of the financial services system is built around distribution, not about education and execution. So if you're out there and you're working with a regular mass affluent type firm, it's like going to eat at a fast food restaurant. Whereas the stuff that you're talking about and the stuff that I'm talking about is the type of stuff that you're going to get at a high-end fancy restaurant where you're looking for more of that wow experience, but it's customized to what's going on in my life and the products and strategies that are probably a better fit for me.
Matt, you didn't get your letter from the IRS saying you're rich?
You mean other than the tax bill that they send?
Yeah, I use that one a lot. Nobody sends you that letter. It says, hey, you're rich. Now you can start benefiting from this stuff. But one of the nice things is even if you're not super wealthy, this stuff still impacts people and you can still take advantage of just understanding some of our listeners. I mean, we have people on opposite ends of the spectrum. We have people just starting out who are newer to investing and newer recent graduates in college. And then we have people who are pretty successful and they've a lot of schooling background and everyone's looking for these type of things. So I think it's great that you've been able to come on and share a lot of your knowledge here because I think everyone's going to be able to benefit. And I definitely want to have you back on the show at a later time to talk about some more tax loopholes because I know you've got a ton of them. And these tend to be the most popular podcasts, at least from listener feedback, because everybody loves this stuff. Just understand how they can save more taxes and make more money. So I appreciate you coming on the show, Matt. You want to tell everyone where they can find you and learn more about you?
Sure. That would be great. And let me address what you said. Just knowing that there's tax opportunities out there for planning is the important thing. So if you're not an accredited investor status, which many of these things you need to be, there's some of this stuff that works even at a lower level than that across what's, I mean, the industry terms it kind of mass affluent, but it doesn't hurt to ask and know that it's out there. And if you're a younger person and you're building and you're saving for the first time, just realize there's stuff out there that might not be in widespread distribution because the stuff you read about in the financial publications or here in the financial news, they're selling eyeballs and clicks, and they have to do that to the broad markets to get mass appeal. They're not talking to very tight, finite niches because they won't have enough people respond. Just be mindful that this stuff's out there, even though you haven't heard of it before, but yet don't be gullible. Trust and verify. But Kirk, I appreciate you having me. And I would say if anybody's interested in looking me up a little bit, one of the best ways to probably find me is you can go to my website, www.mattchancey.com. So it's mattchanceylive.com and talks a little bit about me and some of the tax planning stuff we do. Gives you the ability to schedule an appointment and have a conversation and see if there's some strategies that might be able to help you accomplish some of your goals.
Great. Well, certainly we'll put all this in the show notes. So if you guys didn't get that, you can look it up in the show notes. We'll have all these links and a certain little bit more about Matt. Well, great, Matt. We certainly appreciate you coming on the show and look forward to having you on soon.
You got it. Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks, everyone.
Hey, Money Tree Podcast listeners. We finally chosen our March Madness promotion winner. Please check out our website, moneytreepodcast.com, to see if you've won. If you didn't win, don't worry because we're running another promotion this month, which ends on June 1st. This promotion is for another $50 Amazon gift card. Please sign up to our email list for a chance to win. You can also go to our website link, moneytreepodcast.com/survey2019, for an additional chance to win by filling out a survey and letting us know your thoughts about our show. Now we're going to be entering the panel portion of our show. So let's introduce our panel experts. Today we have Miranda. How's it going, Miranda?
Doing all right. Getting it done.
Good. Well, Miranda is our personal finance specialist with small businesses investing topics. You know, all know Miranda. She's been here for most of the life of the show.
The entire life of the show.
Well, I tried to compliment you last week and you didn't take kindly to it. So I'm going to underplay it this week. And then we also have Tim Pachote. He's also an expert in cryptocurrencies. So we've had Tim on in the past, and we love to have his input, especially in a show like this when we're talking about tax loopholes for the rich. We had a guest on, Matt Chancey, which talked about economic opportunity zones, which is a topic that not a lot of people are familiar with. It's a brand new tax rule that came out recently, and I find it to be fascinating because it's one of the probably one of the only ones that I know of, where you can actually get tax benefits after you've sold an asset. There are a lot of tax benefits you can take advantage of before you've sold an asset, but afterwards you're highly limited. And this is one of those things that just, I think a lot of people with taxable gains have climbed on board for. I know I've gotten a ton of calls from people about this topic. So I want to kind of bring this to the panel because it's an interesting topic that probably a lot of listeners may not have heard of before. Let's start with Miranda. So what do you think about this topic of the economic opportunity zones?
Yeah, I really like it. And like Matt pointed out, you know, it's something that works well for, it's one of those great instances where people from disparate political backgrounds can come together and say, hey, this is something that helps accomplish goals that we generally, you know, we all enjoy. And so it's something that involves a little bit of compromise. It's something that helps different people accomplish different goals. And so I really think that it's an interesting idea to help people get involved with growing their communities and investing in their communities. So I think it's a really interesting idea, and I kind of like it.
Cool. Yeah, I think that point's really important, because while we talk about this from a tax perspective, right, there's a reason why this has bipartisan support. You know, it's because it's appealing to both sides. It appeals to the wealthy who want the tax benefits, but it also appeals to people who want to improve some communities and make everybody's life better, even people who are kind of economically disadvantaged.
Right. And when you invest in your communities and you show that investment in your communities, everybody benefits from an increase in tax base, an increase in services, and an increase in quality of life. It's not always just about the money when you're talking about investments.
But it's mostly about the money, right?
Well, when you're talking about your bottom line, it surely is. Let's ask Tim.
Yes, Tim. What do you think about this?
I think we should just make the entire country an economic opportunity zone and not have to worry about little areas. But this is what I really liked about this was the fact that if you did hold on to the investment for, I believe it's more than 10 years, your basis would then step up to the fair market value of the investment after 10 years. So, I mean, if you put $1 million in and now you're doing things the right way and made some great investments, whether passive or active, and now let's say you've got a $5 million asset, just to be able to have the basis of that jump up to $5 million and being able to defer the taxation for I think 7 years, it was 10% or no, sorry, 5 years, 10%, and 7 years, 15%. And so Matt did touch on the time value of money and how important that was. And this is something where if somebody knows what they're doing, which is the important part of this, that it could be a gigantic opportunity. And you had touched on, Kirk, earlier that this is one of the few, if not one of the only, potentially the only way where if you've already, after the fact, sold something, where there could be a way to help defer that taxation. Because a lot of times what happens to potential prospects for myself, and I'm sure yourself as well, and actually I know this for you because you've come in and asked me, like, hey, I've had a client who sold this for X amount of millions of dollars. What can they do? And until now, it was, you know, there was very little they could do. And so this is, you know, it's just one more, you know, I guess, arrow in our quiver to help people out, you know, if it makes sense for them.
Yeah, and I think you touched on a good point, because I think we as wealth managers, we're always trying to push the envelope within legal bounds in terms of what we can do for clients. Because we've come across, I mean, Tim, you and I have worked on a number of clients with this, where clients have a specific tax situation. There are a lot of good accountants out there, but I think the vast majority of them are not proactive tax planners. You know, they're not looking at client situation saying, hey, I saw that you sold this last year. We need to talk about economic opportunity zones. Or, hey, you've got this big gain. We should really talk about how to plan around this to minimize your taxes. And realistically, they should be the ones having these conversations, but most of them don't because they're too busy. I mean, try to get an accountant from February until May 1st. You're probably not going to get anyone on the phone. They're just really busy people. So they don't really have time to do all of this. And in many ways, it comes down to us as a profession to do a lot of this planning for people. So a lot of times we sit here and, you know, rack our brains about how we're going to come up with the best tax strategy for certain situations. And as an example, with the economic opportunity zones, the one thing I really like, and we talked about time value of money here a little bit, but if you kind of compare, there's two pieces to this. One is the perceived value of the tax benefits. And then there's the other piece, which is the investment benefits. I haven't seen a lot of articles that kind of wrap the two together. Most of them talk about the tax benefits, but they kind of miss the investing piece. So the tax benefits could be significant, but you can't let the tax tail wag the dog, I think, as Matt said. Some of these benefits are significant, right? So you get 5 years, you get a 10% reduction in your gain amount. For 7 years, you get a total of 15, so an additional 5. That's a significant savings. But on top of that, your whole gain is basically tax-free of the investment piece. And I think a lot of people aren't talking about the investment piece enough, because you get until, I think, 2047. So if you invest in a property, you have until 2047 to sell it and you get no taxes on the gain. I mean, that's significant. That's 28 years. You know, I was running some numbers and if you're looking at 5 or 7 years, the taxes are something. You know, they're not going to make you a millionaire overnight, but it's a benefit. But I think what most people do is they see this real golden goose of an opportunity, and they invest in something that may not be the right investment for them. They just do it for the tax benefits. And Wall Street is great at making these investment products. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad, but they're really good at creating products, and you never really know if they're good or bad until later. You know, and you're kind of experienced, Tim, like what have you seen in this area for kind of investment products around tax benefits?
Well, I think when you had talked about, you know, for me, when I first was hearing Matt talk about this and he had mentioned, hey, if you hold on to it for 5 years, you get 10%, and hold on to it for another 2 years, you get another 5%. I mean, it was really sort of like a yawn for me, like, okay, yeah, big deal. We've got to tie up our money for this long. But then when he mentioned the other component to this, which is where you could have it step up in basis, for me, that was kind of like the big like aha moment of like, wow, that's sort of where the value comes in for me. Certainly there's, you know, the other aspect shouldn't diminish that as well, especially if you don't have the liquidity to pay a big tax hit up front. But yeah, you know, the one thing with Wall Street, you know, I did, you know, just like yourself, who started in, was it 98 or 99? I started the day Lehman Brothers crashed. And so, you know, I'm very aware that Wall Street is always willing to package some sort of product together, or, you know, put some crap together and bundle it up. And if there's a way for them to make 1 or 2%, sometimes they don't necessarily care what the underlying asset is because they're there to make their percentage. So investors do need to make sure that the investment is an actual good underlying investment and not just getting into it for the tax breaks. But for the person that you know, is in that right situation, I think it can be very beneficial to them. But it looks like there is, you know, a lot of some questions still around this that I believe your guest brought up in terms of, you know, how does it work if you, you know, have a business inside of one of these zones and you're, maybe it's an online business and you're selling to somebody across the country who's not in an economic opportunity zone, how does that work? Or, you know, I guess some other questions I'd have, you know, what if, let's say you bought a piece of real estate inside of one of these zones, or you had a business inside of one of these zones, and what if you sold it before 5 years, but then used the money like a 1031 to buy another asset inside of these zones? Can you, if the sale is made within the zone, like can that be potentially? Yeah, so my head is sort of like spinning with different potential ways for people to help maximize their own personal tax situation. And a lot of times, most advisors out there, a lot of advisors, at least the ones who aren't good, will just say, hey, well, you know, if we made money, well, then that's, you know, paying taxes is just the consequence of making money. And they don't realize that there are ways to where you can rearrange your assets tax efficiently. Like you can have income producing assets inside of IRAs. You can have growth assets. Capital gains assets are probably better positioned outside of IRAs, or maybe even Roth IRAs, as you guys did allude to in the past. Because I definitely do love the potential Roth conversion, although that doesn't really play too much, I guess, into this because you're probably using non-IRA assets to make this sort of change, especially if you're trying to defer the capital gain sale anyways. So yeah, so in terms of Wall Street, I mean, you know, you got to be careful because they're always going to try to package something up, and whether it's in your best interest or not, you've got to really kind of do your own due diligence. But it's going to be interesting to see, you know, as it starts taking off, I'm sure, you know, right now we're sort of, I'm not sure if we're necessarily at the ground floor of it, but in terms of people that are aware of this stuff going on, I would say it's probably still few and far between right now in terms of people that actually know that this even exists or how to actually implement it.
Yeah, and you make a really good point, because one of the challenges with a lot of these new rules is they're really pushed through quickly. And I think anybody who's just went through tax season probably realizes that there's a lot of unknowns. Accountants are still trying to figure some of this stuff out. I know when I got my taxes done, my accountant's like, well, yeah, you get this benefit if the K-1 says this, but your K-1 doesn't say that, even though it should. And the IRS put out some sort of notice saying that if you don't put this here, then you don't get credit for it. If these rules have been out for years, most people are up to date. You know, they're not making mistakes, but when they get pushed through really quickly, there are a lot of smart people out here, and they find the loopholes, and they find the places, they find the questions that aren't clear. And to your point about businesses, there's a lot of this economic opportunity zone, which is still not entirely clear to people, like businesses. I guess the IRS is putting out, their thoughts on certain questions at the end of April, because when it comes to businesses, there's a lot. With real estate, it's a little bit more clear. You know, you have real estate, somebody's renting it, real estate is in one place, it's not moving. But a business, you're selling to people all over the world potentially. So what if you're only selling to people in Hawaii? Do you still qualify as an economic opportunity zone if you're located in Connecticut? There's just a lot of question marks out there that I think a lot of people are waiting for clarification to make their decisions. But the fact that this is such a well-supported piece of tax legislation, that I think what'll probably happen is, from what I've been hearing, is this rule, they're going to test it out, see how it works, figure out where things go. And if it's successful, they're going to do more of it. Because when you have bipartisan support, which in this day and age is almost never happens, it's really easy to kind of pass through more of this stuff because it's easy to do. So, you know, Miranda, what you've been in the personal finance space a long time. And again, what have you seen in terms of kind of how Wall Street packages up products for different benefits, whether they kind of work out or don't work out?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot to be said about being careful about what you get. I do actually like, as an indexer, some of the index products that they package. They're low cost. They make it easy to get started investing. They make it simple. But you do have to be careful because there are some things that start to get a little complicated. You don't know really what's happening. You don't understand the underlying investments. Like, you start to get to this point where you have credit default swaps, you know, those famous things. And you have all these things that can start to get a little bit complicated. And it's really important that you can dig in and understand what it is exactly that you're buying. I think a really good example, and it's not necessarily, I guess, Wall Street, but it's sort of up there in the financial industry right now, really popular, is real estate crowdfunding. And you really have to understand what you're buying into if you do one of these crowdfunding projects. Are you buying into a portfolio of notes? Or are you actually investing in a real estate development project and you're going to have a piece of the appreciation? Or are you just investing in a portfolio of notes that'll give you some income off of the mortgage and the interest that the borrowers pay, but no appreciation? Or are you investing in a real estate development? And understanding that is not always easy when you go to an investing crowdfunding site. So I think when we're looking at these fast moving things, when we're looking at stuff that seems really awesome and really packaged and really easy, you do have to be careful. You do have to watch out for fees, and you do have to really do your due diligence to understand what is happening.
Yeah. And you actually make a great point, Miranda, because due diligence is, at least kind of how I look at things, is one of the most important things you can do. I put it in the category of risk management. And we'll probably actually have Matt back on the show, maybe even as a panelist, because he's got more stories than Mother Goose with his experiences, and they're really interesting stories. And it comes a lot to his experience in due diligence. You mentioned about the credit default swaps. I mean, my business partner, you look at Wall Street and they create a rule, and Wall Street finds a way around its rule. You know, that's kind of the whole point. Right. And you have a lot of smart people in a room, and that's their job, is to find a way around it. My business partner, that was his former job. That was all he did. Was the bank he worked for tasked him to go find a way around certain rules legally, obviously. But it's fascinating because that's how these institutions operate. Their job is to make money and obviously make it marketable for other people. But, you know, it makes it even harder to do due diligence in a lot of these projects because of the fact that they're not entirely transparent. They're not giving you all the information you need. And more importantly, how many people out here are equipped to actually do this due diligence? I mean, there are companies out there which, if you created, for an example, if you wanted to create a fund, you know, let's say you had this idea and you wanted to create a fund and you wanted to provide due diligence to investors. I mean, there's companies who do a really, really good job at this. There's some of the top around there. They might charge you $75,000 or $100,000 to do due diligence. And that's like unbiased due diligence. They're going to find every problem, every issue. They're really good, but they're also very expensive. For most people, like, we don't have the background, the skill sets to do all of the most important things. I mean, publicly traded stocks are more or less transparent. And even professional investors find it hard to do research on some of these companies. So I think it's a great point you made, Miranda, about the due diligence process. It's certainly one of the challenges that we face in investing. I do want to talk a little bit about the Roth conversion that Matt had brought up, because I think it's an interesting facet that we've come across, certainly when we're working with clients. But Miranda, have you utilized this, or have you kind of seen it other people utilize this successfully with the Roth conversion?
Well, not particularly like with real estate or whatever. But I've seen people use, you know, they call it a backdoor Roth, where they take like a traditional IRA and then transfer it into a Roth. If they think that they're having a year where their income's a little bit lower and they can make that transition and pay the taxes on it, it works out well for them. A lot of them, though, realize that if they transfer their entire IRA into a Roth in 1 year, it's probably going to destroy them in terms of taxes. And before you do something like this, it is really important to take a look at the tax impact, because a lot of the time people are like, oh, this is great, I'll get tax-free growth in the future. But they forget that if they've done a traditional IRA, they're going to have to pay taxes on the amount that they convert. And so being able to take a step back and say, okay, maybe I shouldn't convert the whole thing. But I've seen people use it. I've seen people, they know they can't contribute to a Roth IRA during the year because they make too much money. And so they make, you know, they're like for 2019, you can contribute up to $6,000 if you're under the age of 50. So they'll say, all right, well, I'm going to go ahead and contribute $6,000 to a traditional IRA. And then, you know, later on, I'm just going to convert that $6,000 into a Roth. You know, if you're not careful, you could end up with a lot of disparate accounts, a bunch of rollover accounts. But, you know, once again, I think it goes back to, you know, Matt mentioned, you know, partnering people who know what they're doing and understanding. And if you don't know the tax consequences, if you're not sure how to do it the best way for your taxes, get somebody who does know. I mean, I have an accountant for a reason, and we sat down and talked about it, and, you know, a 5-minute conversation with my accountant and talking over, well, maybe I should contribute an extra $1,000 to my HSA this year for taxes, and talking about, you know, how that would work and what that would look like and how that would impact my taxes. You know, the man cut my tax bill in half. So just being able to talk to somebody who knows and understands and who can talk you through it can be worth whatever money you pay for that expertise.
Yeah, and I think you make some great points. I mean, having a good, knowledgeable partner in your activities is really important, whether it's a financial advisor that you're working with or whether it's a tax advisor or a legal advisor. I think there's a segment of people out there that are do-it-yourselfers. And I know I'm one, and I'm sure people on the panel are also do-it-yourselfers to some degree. But even some of the smartest people out there who are some of the best investors around, even they realize that they're not experts in everything. I know a lot of professionals think that they're really good. Like, you know, I won't name the professions because I think there's some listeners here, but there's certain professions that are, you know, that they have a sense of being really smart because they are. And they think that that intelligence in one area passes through to other areas and other professions. And there's intelligence and then there's wisdom, right? I mean, you can read everything you want to know about investing, but it doesn't mean you're going to make wise decisions, because a lot of the wisdom comes from experience and from seeing, you know, how the markets operate. You can't read in a textbook how the crash of 2008 happened and assume that you know what you're going to do. You just don't. It's not just intellectual decisions. It's emotional decisions that drive our behaviors. And that's the part that is really hard for people to understand, is they think intellectually, well, I understand this. And then emotionally, their emotions drive them and they don't see it. And it ends up, you know, destroying their wealth. So having good partners that can kind of see you through some of these potholes really helps. And just as kind of a follow-up example with the Roth IRA conversions. So I've spoken to some hedge fund managers, names that listeners have probably have heard of. You try to explain to them the difference between a traditional and a Roth, and they naturally think the Roth is a better choice. That's not necessarily true. So a lot of people just say, I want to convert into a Roth because it's tax-free. But if you look at the net at the end of the day, the traditional and the Roth, all else being equal, are identical. You will get an identical rate of return from a traditional or Roth if all other factors are equal. The difference really comes to what your tax rate is. And certainly, you know, I want to hear from Tim because Tim's got some experience in this too, but the tax rate is one of the most important determining factors, your tax rate going in and tax rate going out. Besides that, everything else is planning and you're subject to chance. But Tim, let's hear from you, because I know that you've certainly done a lot of these, but what are your thoughts on the Roth conversion, as kind of Matt talked about?
Yeah, I mean, this is something I've been a big fan of. I mean, obviously, it needs to be done in the right context because there are traps people can find themselves in, especially if you're just, you know, sort of hearing about this for the first time. Like for instance, if you have a big 401k and maybe don't have any other outstanding IRAs, then maybe a Roth conversion might make sense for you. But if you, let's say, have a big IRA or several IRAs, and then you want to convert, there are certain rules regarding pro rata conversions where it can start getting messy. Or if you're below the age of 59 and a half and you don't have other outside funds to pay the conversion, you know, then there could be penalties if you need to take funds from your IRA to help pay for the taxes. So there are certain pitfalls people could find themselves in, but for the right person, it definitely makes sense. I mean, I've been doing this for my clients since basically before it was even called the backdoor Roth. I can't remember if it was 2009 or 2010 when they allowed you to convert an IRA to a Roth. And I was like, this is a really easy loophole to get around the whole, I forgot what the amount was, like 110,000-ish income limit. I know it's higher now, but whatever it was back in 2010. So, you know, Miranda made a lot of good points in terms of, you know, hey, you probably don't want to do all this at once. We do, you know, a lot of work with people doing charitable trust planning. With those people, they get gigantic tax breaks up front. And for some of those people, we're thinking, hey, it may make sense to every year take a little bit of your IRA. And maybe if, let's say, you're in the 15% bracket, and then we know you've got, you know, another, let's say, $50,000 to hit the next bracket, well, then let's put $50,000 to convert it. And then, oh yeah, by the way, you also have this big tax deduction over here too. So it's not even going to cost you anything to do it. So there is, you know, a lot of advanced planning, but, you know, a lot of times this is stuff that people aren't necessarily aware of. Or if you're not, you know, working in this every day, there are traps that you can find yourself into. So you do want to make sure you are getting some good advice on this. And, you know, I even ran into a lawyer the other day who heard me give a talk on self-directed IRAs. And so, you know, they went out and did it themselves. And they were so proud of me because they happened to run into me at another conference last week. And then, you know, they start telling me how they, you know, are buying their own house that they're going to live in with their IRA. And they're a lawyer, so they know they can do it. And I'm like, no, my God, you definitely cannot do that. And so, you know, I forgot to even bring that up to you, Kirk. And another thing I just want to bring up as an aside, you know, talk about, you know, wanting clarity in things and talking about, you know, crowdfunding. So last week I was at a security token summit and actually talked with briefly David Weld, who is the father of the Jobs Act and also the guy that basically helped all these new rules around crowdfunding and basically legalize that. And so I do have his info that I could share with you guys, and maybe you can get him on the Money Tree podcast. I think he was former vice chairman of the NASDAQ as well. I think this is a good thing for people, but, you know, it's got to be done in the right context. I mean, if you have an asset that goes up, you know, multi-100% or multi-1,000%, well, maybe now is not a good time to do the Roth conversion. However, you know, a 2009 environment when everything is depressed, well, maybe that's a time. And I was screaming this in 2009. I think that was the first year you could do this, trying to convince people to convert their IRAs to Roth in 2009. And nobody wanted to do it because, you know, it would have been the best move basically possible. Hey, pay a little bit of tax now, and then as everything rides back up. But back then in that environment, people didn't know if things were going to rise up, or people didn't know if there was even going to be a banking system, just because we were in quite the environment back then. So in the right context, it does make a lot of sense. I know Kirk and I are helping people out right now doing crypto Roth conversions, which, you know, some people, luckily, I think we got in on time before the little run-up we had right now. But, you know, I do, not to make it a crypto podcast, but I do think people will be able to get in at better prices again to do this. Big fan of the Roth conversion, but it needs to be done in the right context with the right advice for the right people with the right assets.
Yeah, and those are great points. And I think with the Roth conversion that Matt had talked about, he was talking about, it's kind of a nuance in the Roth conversion strategy, which is basically converting it at a discount. And there's definitely some IRS rules with case law to support these discounts, which is great. I mean, it doesn't just apply to IRAs, it applies to other assets. So it's, you know, I mean, you can get a huge discount off these assets with conversion. And there's a lot of nuances that we do when we work with that, with the self-directed IRAs. But I think in anything you do, I mean, always have to worry about red flags. And I think we were talking about this earlier. There's what you can do and there's what you should do. You know, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. If you're going to get audited every other year, then you probably shouldn't do something that you legally can do, because it's just going to make your life hell. And obviously, when we do things, we're by the books, so we make sure that's not the case. But I'm interested in hearing that story about the person who wanted to live in their IRA property, because I've actually run into somebody who's selling that idea to people. And I shake my head and say, you're causing people to lose enormous amounts of money. But if I had to call Harry Markopoulos up and get a piece of these things, all these frauds that people are perpetuating, it's really shocking. But yeah, so I want to wrap this up here because we're going a little long, but I think we're going to have more shows about tax loopholes of the rich, because there's so many out there that we think investors can take advantage of. And, you know, most of them are not, you know, they're not brain surgery. Some of them are a little bit more complex, and you should work with experienced professionals, because just learning the stuff itself and how it all interacts can get yourself into trouble. But I think it's kind of unanimous on this show. We all feel that even we work with professionals when it's a topic that we're not as familiar with. So I highly recommend that to all the listeners, that they find someone in an area that is an expert in the area they're looking for. But in wrapping up the show, Miranda, how can people find out more about you?
Yeah, just head on over to plantingmoneyseeds.com. You can read the blog. I write about money. But I do have a resources page. If you hit that resources, you can see like the different tools that I use to manage my own money. A lot of people ask me questions about that. Like, how do you do your travel fund? Where do you put it? What are some of the other tools that you use to save money or to manage your money or to make the most of your money? And what I use is fairly simple. It's fairly straightforward and almost anybody can do it. And it may not be the sexiest way of doing things, but it works for me. So if you want to head over to plantingmoneyseeds.com and check the resources section, you can get some ideas for just like simple tools to help you make more of your money.
Great. Thanks, Miranda. And Tim, how can we find out more about you?
You find out more about me both at your website at innovativewealth.com for all the different self-directed IRA things that we had talked about, and also thelibertyadvisor.com. Still trying to rework that right now, but a lot of my media appearances you can find on there. And then also YouTube at World Alternative Media as well.
Cool. Yeah. If anyone comes to our website looking for Tim, you can just message us and just say you're looking for Tim and we'll connect you. But yeah, my name's Kirk Chisholm. I'm wealth manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth. We make your life better. So you can find out more about me at innovativewealth.com. So I want to thank you all for joining us this week on Money Tree Investing Podcast. Remember to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Play. Also, you can check out Money Tree Podcast at our website at moneytreepodcast.com for more information about the show and the show notes, and also to find out the winner of the most recent promotion that we've had. We look forward to having future promotions for you guys, and each subsequent one will be more and more exciting, I think, because there's some really cool ideas that we want to explore with the show, and we'd love to have your feedback on those. So you'll have a chance to access all of our resources and show notes and archive shows on our website. But remember that no one will care about your money like you do, so invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.
Hey, Money Tree Podcast listeners. We've had a great run over the last 5 years. We've had lots of great guests over that time. Guests like Joe Saul Sehy, Susie Orman, Art Laffer, Bert Malkiel, Peter Schiff, and more. We've also had lots of great content, like what happens when somebody steals $500,000 from you, tax loopholes of the rich, investing like a billionaire, why men and women approach investing differently, how to outlive your money, tax liens, peer-to-peer lending, asset protection, and more. We've had lots of great questions from you, our audience, as well. But now we need your help. We want to know what you want to listen to more of, what topics, guests, and content you value most. This is your chance, Money Tree Podcast listeners. We don't frequently ask, but when we do, the door is wide open for you to give us your thoughts, good, bad, or ugly. What do you want to hear more of? What do you want to hear less of? All of this helps us make a better show for you. So many of you have already provided your feedback, and we really appreciate it. This is going to make an exciting 2019 of great content ahead. We're going to be closing the survey soon, so make sure you leave your feedback now. If having a say in your favorite podcast isn't enough, we're also going to be providing monthly promotions to anyone on our email list. The recent promotion was an overwhelming success. We've received lots of great feedback and input from our listeners. We're going to continue to create great shows for you, and they'll be focused on the content that you suggested. Each month, we'll have a new promotion. We can't tell you what we have in store for future promotions, but I know that you're going to be excited. We have some special opportunities that money just can't buy. We're excited to bring these new episodes to you throughout 2019. But in order to qualify for these great promotions that we have coming up, we're going to need to hear from you. However, in order to qualify, you're going to need to sign up for our email list first. When you do, you'll have an additional chance to win by completing our Money Tree podcast survey. Go to moneytreepodcast.com/survey2019 to give us your feedback and for additional chances to win. We'll be posting the name of the winner on our website. So if you've entered the promotion, please check the website to see if you've won. We have some great shows lined up in the near future with some special guests that you're not going to want to miss. I can't wait to publish these interviews. So go to moneytreepodcast.com/survey2019 to sign up, and we'll enter you into our monthly promotion. Thanks again for listening, and remember, invest in your life.